We turn now to a representative of the Western model of spiritual direction, Father Thomas Merton, or Lewis Merton, as he was known in his monastery of Gethsemane. Lewis was his religious name as a Trappist monk, although he wrote under the name Thomas and is therefore more popularly known by that name. Thomas Merton is a very interesting figure. He lived from 1915 to 1968. His biography is fairly well known. He led a very secular and even somewhat wild life as a young man, living in France, the United States, and then being educated at Clare College, Cambridge, then returning to the United States to finish his education in English literature before joining the Monastery of Gethsemane in Kentucky. He was originally baptized as an Anglican, but did not practice his faith that much while living in France or England. He was a convert to Catholicism. And his entry into the monastery prompted his writing one of the most famous descriptions of life in a monastery, The Seven-Story Mountain. If you've read that book and some of the sequels to it, The Sign of Jonas and so forth, you may not be familiar with an aspect of Thomas Merton's approach, which will become obvious in this text and which I hope you do not find disedifying. He tends to use sarcasm and skepticism as a tool to point out what he regards as the inadequacies, particularly of people whose approach is, he feels, being venerated or regarded too highly, when in fact it's highly problematic. You'll find him making some rather sweeping generalizations in this article, which, although very helpful and very useful, might seem somewhat perplexing to some. It's a heuristic, that is to say, a pedagogical style, in order to, as it were, wake up the person who might be slumbering while reading to confront this rather confrontative approach. This text on spiritual direction is divided into five subsections. We will consider the first three in this lecture, and there will be a second lecture that considers the other half, in the last two sections. This treatise on spiritual direction, again, may also seem surprising for those who imagine that Thomas Merton was principally someone who was engaged in dialogue with the non-Christian East. In fact, that represented an aspect of his life that was only occupied him in the latter few years. In his earlier years, he was very much involved in formation work, that is to say, he was responsible as a superior for some of the young monks in his monastery who were in training. In fact, there are cassette tapes of his conferences to the juniors. He was the junior master, that is, the individual responsible for young monks during their triennial vows, before the period of having made their solemn or final vows. And many of his conferences are available through credence cassettes and are well worth listening to, although you may find his style, again, a little off-putting. He has a rather abrasive approach. And many people on listening to those tapes are grateful that they have the opportunity to read his books rather than actually being one of his juniors. This text on spiritual direction, as you will see, is written primarily with monks and nuns in mind. It is not intended as a treatise primarily directed towards laypersons, but it certainly includes his own thoughts of the value of direction in regard to the laity. And it reflects the spiritual conditions of the Catholic Church, particularly as it was in the late 40s and throughout the 50s. So some of the language and terminology and even the issues that he mentions and seems to be reacting against are perhaps a little less prominent today, although some individuals would like them to be restored to a position of prominence, and for that reason perhaps Thomas Merton's observations will be particularly helpful for us. As I mentioned, we'll consider the first three sections in this first lecture. I've, as I said, divided it up and numbered these sections, and there are sub-numbers at the beginning of many paragraphs, which will be a way of following along on the page as I talk about the text. I've highlighted material, and again, I would invite you, as with other texts, to please go back and peruse this text in more detail on your own. We're only going to look at some of the high points. Beginning with the first section, the meaning and purpose of spiritual direction. He points out that in the early church, there, and we will look at this in some detail and perhaps disagree slightly with some of his assertions, but on the whole, I think what he says is quite valid. He points out that in the very early Christian church, there was no spiritual direction in the sense of a one-to-one relationship with individuals. And he puts it even more strongly. He says there was no particular need of personal spiritual direction because the bishop, as he puts it, the living, invisible representative of the apostle, spoke for Christ and the apostles, and assisted by the presbyters, took care of the spiritual needs of his flock. So individual Christians were expected to have their spiritual needs dealt with by the clergy, by the bishop and presbyters for the most part. He then goes on to point out that this formation, this guidance, was not just by the clergy. Number one in this little subsection, first of all by bishops and presbyters, although informally by parents, by spouse, by friends, and by fellow Christians. This is the situation as he describes it in the primordial or early church prior to the rise of monasticism. And for Thomas Merton, in his understanding of the historical development of this tradition, it really is with the rise of Christian monasticism that both the practice of and the need for spiritual direction arises. As we'll see later, he is convinced that spiritual direction in a one-to-one regular basis is necessary for those who are in religious vows, especially those who are in initial formation, but he is not as convinced that it is as necessary for lay people, for Christians living in the world outside the monastic context. And again, this all needs to be taken with something of a grain of salt and borne in mind that this is a spiritual mindset that is reflective particularly of the late 40s and 50s in Roman Catholic tradition. So if we look at section 1-2, he describes the retiring of the first solitaries into the desert, and he speaks about the dangers of the desert. There they were to be tempted by the evil one, and thus there was a need for discernment, diakrisis, this tradition which we will look at in considerably more detail, particularly in Cassian and in Evagrius. So their deliberate withdrawal from the normal life of the church, and this is the highlighted text, was a perilous spiritual adventure. And he says, in many ways, it would be appropriately considered out of the question by many today. And in order for this adventure to be successful, training and guidance of the novice by a spiritual father was necessary. So he's rooting the one-to-one Christian tradition of spiritual direction in the monastic tradition and describing that as the primary context out of which it evolves. He states also that it was purely and simply charismatic, sanctioned by the spiritual father's own personal holiness. And he points out that in the early tradition, the greatest spiritual fathers and mothers, one should add, of the Egyptian and Syrian desert were generally not priests. This is true, but that statement can't just be taken as some sort of an indication that the clergy were in any way disenfranchised. The situation of ecclesiology in Christianity was very different in those days from what it is today. But that's another question which we'll deal with at a later point in our course. He goes into the apophthegmata in a very general sort of way and derives in section 1-3 what he calls the root meaning of spiritual direction. And he says it is a continuous process of formation and guidance. Number two, that the Christian is led and encouraged in their special vocation, and by correspondence to the graces of the Holy Spirit, they can attain the particular end of their vocation. And he's thinking here, again, in a very pre-Vatican II way, of the extremely different vocations of the laity and of those who are in vows or who are in orders. But finally, led into union with God. So direction is continuous. It involves an awareness of a special vocation, cooperation with the Spirit, a growth in the ability to cooperate with the Spirit, leading ultimately to union with God, which he goes on to point out is described as purity of heart, particularly by Cassian, and he describes an obscure experience of heavenly things, which we would describe, of course, as a kind of contemplative experience, although he'll have some very harsh words for those who are, in some sense, obsessed with the language and the imagery of the contemplative or mystical tradition. So, carrying on in section 1-4, he points out that this is different from counseling or psychotherapy. It really has to do with a spiritual orientation. The spiritual individual, whether it is the director or the person being directed, is seeking to be directed by God, seeking to be docile to be responsive to the action of the Holy Spirit. It is about doing all for the glory of God. In section 1.5, he mentions a kind of historical curiosity. He mentions the Cistercian lay brothers in 12th century England, who had a great reputation for the ability to read and guide souls, and he suggests that maybe this contains some sort of nonsense in a sudden popular craze. It was a kind of credulity that caused people to frequent the recluses and anchoresses immured near village churches, who he says, undoubtedly though quite pious, had a universal reputation also for being gossips. And here again we can see his rather harsh approach. He wants to make sure that just because there was a flurry of excitement for the consulting of hermits and hermitesses in the 12th century, that doesn't necessarily mean that these people were gifted guides or that their texts need to be regarded uncritically. Many of them were quite human, and in some cases were not always the best examples. He says in the next paragraph, direction speaks to the whole person and the circumstances of their life, and he says it's not a question of discussing the relative merits of the discipline and the hair shirt, which were still actively used in the monastic life of his day, the discipline being a kind of whip, not quite as horrible or grotesque as people might imagine, which was used particularly during the recitation of the Confiteor, one of the Psalms of Penitence, at certain times, penitential seasons, and at certain times of the day. And he says, it's also not a matter of determining whether or not one has reached the, quote, prayer of quiet, unquote. We'll see again, he's very concerned about people who are eager to determine exactly what stage they've achieved in Christian holiness, how far up they are in the ladder of sanctity, and to know exactly which terminology applies to their kind of prayer. Merton regards this as an unwholesome and unhealthy obsession, which must be set aside if one is to grow in the spiritual life. The goal of spiritual direction, he says in 1.6, is to penetrate beneath the surface of the life to bring out inner spiritual freedom, innermost truth. The goal of the director is to verify and encourage what is truly spiritual, teaching others to discern between good and evil. And then he points out that in the ancient tradition, the spiritual father was a father who begets, in the sense of a creative relationship, the perfect life in the soul of the disciple, first by instruction, but also by prayer, sanctity, and example. This individual was to, and note he says the young monk, he is thinking primarily about the monastic context, the spiritual director was a kind of living sacrament of the Lord's presence. This is like that charismatic model that we particularly have seen in Callistos, where in his description of the traditional Eastern starets or geron. If we drop down to section 1.7, he says we are to recover, to rescue the concept of spiritual direction from its impoverished condition, in which the director is one to whom we apply for quasi-infallible solutions to moral and ascetic cases. In the next section, he has nothing but skepticism, even contempt for those who regard themselves as having an infallible system. They have become an expert in the workings of somebody else's system, which, having been approved by the church, is devoutly believed to be infallible in every case, no matter how applied, and used arbitrarily with supreme disregard for individual circumstances. You can see he has no tolerance for spiritual directors who have a method or a series of categories into which they fit their directees, advising them simply on the basis of that system. He says, in contrast, the first thing that genuine direction requires in order to work properly is a normal, spontaneous human relationship. And here we can catch the edge, probably, of what he found in his own experiences of direction that were particularly unhelpful. People who would be regarded as supernatural, that is to say, very spiritual in their approach, because they represented things that were difficult or even repugnant. And he says that this is really inappropriate. And he goes on to parody a kind of a terrible model of acquiescence to this regimented notion of spiritual progress, and it's down toward the end of this section. Result: a procession of robot, quote, victim souls moving jerkily from exercise to exercise in the spiritual life, secretly hating the whole business and praying for an early death, meanwhile offering it up so that the whole may not be lost. Obviously, no direction at all is preferable to such direction as this. It is the bane of the religious life. The director, who invites the person simply to regard themselves as a victim soul, offering the whole of their pain, their experience of frustration, and imagining that that necessarily causes them to move forward in holiness. In contrast, he quotes Augustine Baker, a Benedictine of the English Benedictine congregation, when they were still living in exile on the continent before they were allowed back into England. Augustine Baker says, the director is not to teach his own way, nor any determinate way of prayer, but to instruct his disciples how they may themselves find the proper way for them. He becomes God's usher, leads the soul in God's way and not his own. So the director is to have a level of humility and a willingness to see what is really going on in the soul of this individual. In section two, is direction necessary? We can move very quickly through this. He reminds us that, as in the early church, he suggests that for the laity, the ordinary contacts of the faithful with their pastor and confessor are sufficient to take care of their needs. That is presuming that they are known to their pastor and that they have a regular confessor, which of course in very large parishes and with a clergy shortage is rather unlikely these days. People might argue with that, probably would argue with it now, but again, it represents the approach of the 1950s and 40s. He says if a layman has special work to do for the church, they certainly ought to have a director. And then he points out in section 2.3 that for the religious, direction is a much more serious matter. If we drop down, we'll note that although he will be fairly clerical in his approach to this, recommending priests as directors in particular, he does point out that in the case of nuns, a wise prioress or a good novice mistress should be capable of some direction in what he regards as a kind of a general sense, the ability to grow in leading a fruitful, happy, and intelligent spiritual life. Now, what we find in this highlighted black text just before section 2.4 is a fascinating statement. Those who have years of experience in the religious life are presumably able to direct themselves. So Merton's notion is that spiritual direction, especially in one's early period of formation, should lead progressively to less and less dependence on or need for a spiritual director. But that doesn't mean that you don't need one at all. He goes on to say, even they, that is someone with much experience in religious life, sometimes need to consult a wise spiritual guide. No religious should assume that he has absolutely no need at any time of spiritual direction. And he states that again. In general, in section 2.4, we might profitably reiterate the statement that a mature religious should normally be able to direct themselves. What he means by this, and it's in the section that's highlighted a little further on, is that we should not flee from responsibility and make such a fetish out of direction that we refuse to move an inch, as he puts it, without being put under obedience. In other words, having someone else assume responsibility for us. So spiritual direction should not be a way of avoiding individual responsibility for making decisions, even difficult decisions. And then he goes on to say what is reiterated by Christians throughout the centuries, especially by St. Teresa of Avila, that spiritual directors are not easy to find even in the religious life. And then in section 3, which is the last section we're going to look at in this lecture, he talks about how to profit by direction, and we can summarize by saying that even if the direction one's receiving isn't that great, one should try to find God in it, and God will be there for us. He says, even in the first paragraph, even if your director is not another Saint Benedict or John of the Cross, this person may nevertheless be speaking in the name of Christ, acting as his instrument. And he wants us to have a realistic expectation of direction in section 3.2. We must not imagine that it is miraculous, that it works wonders. It turns out that a director may not tell us anything we don't already know, but the director will reveal to us things we have hitherto been unable to see, even though they were staring us in the face. So occasionally, the spiritual director is someone who says to us stuff that we already know at one level, but have not been paying attention to or haven't seen as clearly. So it may not be a matter of this tremendously charismatic person with an absolutely powerful healing word, but someone who holds up a kind of a spiritual mirror to us and allows us to see ourselves more clearly. Then in section 3.3, he talks about people who want to use their director to turn their own desires into the, quote, will of God, and he'll have none of that. He's a little sarcastic about that as well. In section 3.4, he particularly emphasizes that we should not be overly attentive to our own efforts and pay exaggerated attention to our spiritual life. He says we should not be overly preoccupied with ourselves, our own petty concerns. He goes on to say that the direction giving after confession is sometimes not as good as we might want, but nevertheless, the Lord will work with that. So as we can see, Merton is particularly concerned to reassure people that even if the direction they're receiving is not perfect, nevertheless, they should seek to find something of God in it and not try to find a director who will confirm them in a kind of obsessive fixation on the details of their inner spiritual life. That is to say, as he puts it, to cater to their illusions about themselves. And we'll see in the next section how he goes on to take up this theme and develop it in more detail.